Shabbat shalom. When it comes to Bruce Springsteen, if I had to categorize my level of fandom, I would call myself conservadox, firmly established on the traditional end of the spectrum. From the outset, let me also clarify that I'm by no means overly zealous in my enthusiasm. Only once in my life have I traveled to another city to see him in concert. There do exist lyrics to his music with which I'm unfamiliar, and I have not pre-ordered his autobiography due out next week. And unlike some people with whom I share the pulpit, I limit myself to just one sermon per year making reference to him today. That said, a picture of him does sit proudly on the wall of my office. E Street Radio is a preset station in my car, and I can say with reasonable confidence that my children are well familiar with the most important tracks of his music catalog. So as I conduct a spiritual inventory of the year gone by, I can share with some pride that on the Bruce front, it's been a very good year. Not once, not twice, but three times I saw him in concert with my wife, with a generous congregant who took me and Cantor Schwartz as a gala auction item, and finally and most sweetly with one of my daughters. Each of the concerts, two at Madison Square Garden and one at Barclays, were part of what was called the River Tour, a concert performed in honor of the 35th anniversary of the release of Springsteen's celebrated album, The River. The River remains Springsteen's sole double album, 21 songs total, the most famous being Hungry Heart, which reached number 5, and my personal favorite, Sherry Darling. Perhaps the most interesting thing about the concert, and it's on this point that I want to focus on today, is the fact that in every show, Bruce performed the entire album from beginning to end. Every show, yes, included a set of varied fan favorites, but the point of the concert, the mission of the show, was to showcase this album pivotal to Bruce's development as a musician in the manner it was originally conceived, composed, and constructed. Some songs have stood the test of time better than others, but 35 years later, they were all played with equal fervor by the E Street Band. There would be no cherry picking of songs, no mix and matching. There was an intended arc of the album that would be followed. And the listener, in my case, three times over, was called on to experience the tales of love, heartache, triumph, and tragedy in precisely the way the band intended them to be some 3.5 decades ago. This morning, as I reflect back on those concerts, I cannot help but consider how bold Bruce's decision was to perform in the manner he did, and how countercultural those concert experiences were. Because 35 years later, our world has moved in an altogether different direction. We don't listen to entire albums anymore. We are what I will call, for lack of a better phrase, the Netflix generation. We consume our music, our media, our everything in an on-demand manner that prizes personal choice, immediate gratification, and a la carte lifestyle. When I was a kid, I knew that Different Strokes was on NBC at 8:30 p.m. on Wednesday night to be followed by Facts of Life at 9 p.m. And it was a very, very big deal when it was moved to Saturday night. The dissemination of media was routinized and predictable and then canonized in a TV guide. Today, if you want to watch Veep or House of Cards or anything else, you watch it whenever you and wherever and however fast you want, entire seasons released and binge-watched on a single day. I personally have no idea when the shows I watch are aired. I watch them when I want to. ESPN just announced a la carte bundling so you can stream and pay only for the games you want to watch. Podcasts, including Park Avenues, can be listened to at any time and any place. The music industry is now a singles industry. There's no longer any need to pay for the full album, never mind a double album, and there's no need to listen to that double album from beginning to end in a concert. The more I think about the River Tour, the more I'm struck by the manner in which it ran counter to the dominant impulses of our own day. And as with any moment of technological advance, while we can embrace the brave new world in which we live, I also think it's incumbent upon us to pause and reflect on this new terrain as it transforms our lives, not simply in how we watch television or listen to music, but in the fundamental assumptions of our existence. Because while we can celebrate an increasingly bespoke access to news, music, and otherwise, we also know that there's an underbelly that lurks. I worry that as we download our books and music online and bear witness to the slow asphyxiation of libraries and bookstores, albums and newspapers, we risk losing what I believe to be one of the most important dimensions of the learning experience, what I like to call the serendipitous stumble. Not the book you went into the store or library looking for, but the one next to it, or the song after it, or the article beside the one that you were initially interested in reading. An on-demand world makes no allowance for the B-side dimension of life. If not for the Beatles, I Am the Walrus, Rod Stewart's Maggie May, Prince's Little Red Corvette, and a million other literal and figurative B-sides, our cultural heritage would be altogether impoverished. Learning and culture, and quite frankly, life itself, more often than not, is to be had not by finding what you thought you were looking for, but in flipping over that proverbial vinyl to discover that truth and beauty and love can be found in unexpected places. There are, to be sure, many pitfalls to be considered in this bold new world of ours. I worry, as I've spoken of, that our a la carte age has resulted in a narrow casting or closing of the American mind, and that we choose to listen to only the channels and websites that echo our views without undertaking the burdensome task of engaging with ideas contrary to one's own. I worry about parents and children sitting in their own rooms, on their own laptops, or even at the same kitchen table, plugged into their individualized emails, YouTube channels, and Spotify accounts, what Sherry Turkell calls being alone together. I worry about human beings becoming just another form of content, as the Tinders of the world allow people to swipe one way or another, as if human beings are songs to be played on a playlist. But as a rabbi and Jewish educator, my worries not surprisingly go to the heart of the project which I've committed my life, and that's a project of creating a dynamic Jewish community. Because if, as I believe, that our faith swims in the stream of the cultural context in which it's to be found, and if all content, religious life included, is on its way to being on demand, then what exactly does this bode for the rhythms of Jewish life and living? Last year, I received a call from a friend who shared with me that her children's school vacations fell in such a way that spring break Italy trip fell during Passover. They were and are caring Jews. They understood the conflict, and so what did they do? She shared with me with some excitement the solution that they decided to bump up Seder and Passover by a week and observe the dietary restrictions of the holiday and then enjoy the week of eating pasta in Italy, having celebrated the holiday a week early. And while shifting Passover from one week to the next may seem a little audacious, just think of how many calls I get weekly from would-be wedding couples and B'nai Mitzvah families if I can just move Havdalah, the end of Shabbat, a bit earlier or later so the Simcha can begin or end at the this time or the other. I'm trying to imagine the ancient pilgrim of this week's Torah reading showing up at the temple with his offering of first fruits, not at the specified time, but at a time that was more convenient for his scheduling concerns. Judaism is, as Abraham Joshua Heschel said, a religion of time aimed at the sanctification of time. I get it. More than you know, I get it. We are trying to think through service times, live streaming our services, putting sermons and the cantor's music online. We're giving options of what days kids can go to congregational school. More than you know, we are trying to meet you where you are. But also know that if Judaism and Jewish life is reduced to the same on-demand demands of the rest of our lives that at a certain point it stops being Judaism. Our festivals, our observances, and our prayers are deeply countercultural. There are time-bound demands of when you do and don't light candles, say Kiddush, fast, and pray, amongst hundreds of other Jewish observances. There is an arc, a set album, if you will, to every week, to every season, to every year. It is who we are. These are the ties that bind the Jewish people, the glue of our community in every generation and across the generations. And it's here that we arrive at the nub of the matter. We are, I do believe, deeply mistaken if we celebrate the coming of the Netflix generation as an unqualified triumph of human freedom. Last week, there was a great piece by Andrew Sullivan in New York Magazine about our addiction to information, multitasking, and distraction. The dopamine-like need to be connected, check Facebook, and return emails. We walk down the street, and I'm just as guilty as the next person, phone in hand, dusk to dawn, subjecting ourselves to the gushing flow of information. And so I ask you, in this brave new world of ours, who is the enslaved and who is the liberated? Is it the person who's able to get what they want, how they want, when they want? Or is it the person who is able to shut their phone off for 24 hours, not return emails after a certain hour, come to shul on a Friday night, enjoy a dinner or a walk or a sunset with a loved one, or even, God forbid, alone, without distraction or interruption? As the late philosopher Yeshayahu Leibovitz explained, genuine human freedom is attained only through the religion of mitzvot, meaning only by sitting as a family together at the Shabbat table with no electronics, only by coming to Shabbat services on the first day, the second day of Rosh Hashanah, on Sukkot and beyond, only by showing up to congregational school or an adult Jewish learning class, only by demonstrating that you yourself set the priorities of your spiritual existence and that of your children, do you announce to the world that you, and not anyone else other than you, is a master of your fate and captain of your soul. In just over a week, the Jewish people will gather together to celebrate Rosh Hashanah, our new year. It's a time to press reset, not just on our clocks and calendars, but on the calibration of our souls. Now is the time to ask the painful question of whether we are, in fact, as free as we would claim to be. Is it we who set the tone of our households, the priorities of our day, and the thoughts that occupy our mind? Or have we unwittingly awoken to a world where everything can be downloaded except the very freedom of mind and spirit that we purport to seek? Now is the time to step into the rhythm and the river of Jewish life. Now is the time to choose whether in the year ahead we shall be spiritual paupers or aristocrats of the spirit. Now is the time for Jewish time. Now is the time to be set free. Shabbat Shalom.